about how MMT economists plan to use taxes to punish those individuals and families who already have, quote, too much wealth, end quote, whatever that means. And what will they do with all the cash? Drench it with gasoline and light it on fire like the Joker in The Dark Knight, just with less face paint and fewer henchmen dressed up as clowns? Under MMT, the government does not need tax revenue. All it needs is power. Power over its own currency. Pavlina Cherneva, a professor at economics at Bard College and research associate at the Levy Economics Institute, has repeated many of the same arguments put forward by Ray and Kelton, referring to those foolish liberals concerned about generating tax revenue as tax the rich to pay for progress lefties. As she argued that relying on taxing the rich is a, quote, imaginary umbilical cord that holds the progressive agenda hostage to the oppressors, end quote. To me, Cherneva wrote, this is the definition of a self-induced paralysis, end quote. 4, control of society. Imagine you're on your way home from work and you're driving a little faster than usual because, well, you've had one too many Diet Cokes and you foolishly left the office without using the restroom. Of course, today is your unlucky day. A local police officer catches you driving 37 in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, and before you know it, you're back on your way home with a new passenger in the seat beside you, a $120 speeding ticket. Fines like these exist as deterrents to unwanted or unsafe behaviors. Society, through its elected representatives, have determined that speed limits are needed for protecting other drivers on the road. And police officers have been tasked with ensuring that people follow the law. Speed limits might be annoying or unnecessarily strict at times, but most Americans agree that they do serve an important purpose. Now, of course, every driver also knows that in addition to acting as a deterrent, speeding tickets also function as a vital revenue generator for local law enforcement. So, from some government's perspective, everyone's a winner when a driver receives a speeding ticket. The community is a little safer, and the government coffers are a little more secure. Over time, politicians stumbling through the political minefield of revenue generation schemes have realized that speeding tickets are not only the way to raise revenue while eliminating bad behaviors. Today's fines are issued for all sorts of sins, especially to punish those less sympathetic groups like cigarette smokers. Why not squeeze a few extra bucks out of them by levying a new tobacco tax? They shouldn't be smoking anyway, right? In many cases, governments have gone overboard, imposing a slew of excessive fines and sin taxes to help raise revenue for town, city, state, or federal government, all under the guise of promoting public health, safety, or some other allegedly noble cause. However, in a world dominated by modern monetary theory, there's no reason for governments to pass laws for the purpose of raising tax revenue. The federal government can simply print all the money it needs and then distribute it to state and local officials. So does that mean Kelton and other MMT supporters believe their system could lead to a reduction of fines and sin taxes? Oh, no, of course not. As Kelton notes, under modern monetary theory, governments, quoting, can use taxes to encourage or discourage certain behaviors, to improve public health, to battle climate change, or deter risky speculation in financial markets. Footnote 233. So rather than disincentivizing government from imposing controls on society, a system utilizing modern monetary theory would empower policymakers to use the tax code to manipulate people, even if they no longer have a financially motivated reason to do so. Risk of inflation. Okay, now that you have a solid understanding of how taxes fit into modern monetary theory, let's turn to the big elephant in the room. How do modern monetary theorists plan to stop inflation? Traditionally, when policymakers float the idea of expanding the Federal Reserve's balance sheet or running the printing presses to find a new government program, those of us concerned about the national debt brace for the devaluation of our currency, commonly called inflation. In extreme cases, we are reminded of the recent rampant inflation in Venezuela in 2018, or stories from the 1920s Germany, where money became so worthless under the disastrous policies of the Weimar Republic that families wallpapered their homes literally with cash. In 2008, in Zimbabwe, hyperinflation caused by irresponsible money printing practices became so bad, inflation levels topped at 89.7 sextillion percent. This forced the government, which could barely function under these conditions, to issue bills with increasingly higher bill denominations. In 2009, Zimbabwe released a $100 trillion bill. It's the largest denomination ever printed. But hey, even though the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe made it difficult for families to put food on the table, at least everyone could become a trillionaire. Don't worry, America. MMTers swear that Zimbabwe's hyperinflation hell will just not happen here in the United States. I mean, this time it's different. To defend their position, they usually cite several key arguments. First, the U.S. dollar is a world reserve currency, which means countries across the globe use and accept the dollar when conducting trade, adding an extra level of stability that most other currencies do not enjoy. This one is important, so we're going to come back to it soon and discuss it further. Second, modern monetary theorists like L. Randall Ray argue that most of the worst examples of hyperinflation were brought on by very specific circumstances, such as civil war or huge external debts denominated in a foreign currency. The U.S. dollar's status as the world reserve currency defends against both of these threats, but especially the latter. Third, modern monetary theorists say there is no reason to worry about hyperinflation because Americans have access to the unstoppable weapon of monetary security, the Congressional Budget Office, CBO. And I am not joking. You can't make this stuff up. This is what Kelton said in 2019. Quote, "So the best defense against inflation is a good offense. And what MMT does is try to be kind of hypersensitive to the risks of inflation. I don't see any other macro school of thought pay as careful attention as we do to the inflation risk question. And so what we would say is, look, if you're Congress and you're considering a new spending bill, instead of thinking about the ways in which the new spending will add to the deficit or add to the debt, you should be thinking about the ways in which that the new spending has the risk of accelerating inflation, and then just avoid doing that." She continues, "So instead of going to the Congressional Budget Office and saying, we'd like you to take a look at this piece of legislation and give us feedback, we'd like to know what this bill would do to the debt and deficit over time, instead, go to the Congressional Budget Office or other government agencies and say, we're considering passing this $1 trillion investment in infrastructure. This is our bill. Would you look at it? And we plan to do this spending over the course of the next 5 years. Tell us if that would create problems in the real economy. Evaluate the inflation risk and come back to us and give some feedback." Okay, jeez, can I take a break just before my head explodes? Kelton's preposterous answer to the inflation question is to have the fate of the world's largest economy rely on the predictions of the Congressional Budget Office. Are you kidding me? The CBO is the same dysfunctional agency that has been issuing a steady stream of false projections for decades. Its projection for Obamacare in 2012, the enrollment was off a whopping 150%. For a monetary system that needs to be hypersensitive to the risks of inflation, putting all your eggs in the CBO's broken basket with no bottom in it seems like a catastrophically bad idea. Oh, but wait, it doesn't end there. Kelton also says that inflation can be prevented under MMT by vesting government with enough authority that it could micromanage the economy and thus control inflation. Quote, and so when you think about how to fight inflation, Kelton says, I think the first question to understand is what the source of the inflationary pressure is, and then move forward with a policy tool that you think is going to help you get at that inflation. If you've got inflation resulting from energy price increases, it's probably not going to do much to have the Fed raise interest rates or even have Congress raise taxes. You have to do something else that is going to work, end quote. This solution is the one that provides the real secret herbs and spices that make MMT such an important part of the plan to create 21st century fascism. Let's use Kelton's example of the energy market to illustrate this point. In Kelton's modern monetary theory fantasy, policymakers begin using freshly printed money to chase their goal of 100% renewable energy. Money begins to flow into politically connected companies that start producing big, beautiful new solar panels and wind turbines. Energy prices then start to increase. Well, this is deemed inflation. But the public has no reason to be concerned because the political elites, who are often barely functional human beings themselves to begin with, are given the green light to craft policy tools and use the tax code to fight against rising prices. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? Well, for starters, everything. Why should we believe that the same people who created this brand new inflation-causing energy system would be smart enough to fix the problem that they caused? Why didn't they just design the system to avoid inflation in the first place? And if government officials are so good at problem solving and planning, why haven't they figured out a way to get Amtrak to turn a profit or the Postal Service to stop hemorrhaging billions of dollars every year? Further, does anyone really think politicians are going to cut off spending to well-connected renewable energy companies amid a transition to a world free of fossil fuels? Surely politicians would not put concerns about inflation before the existential threat of global warming, right? In the end, Kelton's system would depend on a scapegoat to blame when everything goes horribly wrong. And in this case, it would be almost certainly fossil fuel companies who have in recent decades fallen out of favor with the ruling elites. It would not be hard to convince those in charge to give oil and gas companies the axe to help bring prices down after government's money printing effort drives them up. You can play these scenarios out in virtually every sector of the economy. Ultimately, trillions of new dollars created by the government would result in inflation, either in the economy as a whole or specific sectors. It would force bureaucrats then to selectively identify the sources of inflationary pressure and then craft policy tools to deal with those problems. It's a perfect plan for those trying to control society. But as for the rest of us, well, we're going to be left out in the cold, especially if the entire country is required to run on wind and solar. At present, elites at the Federal Reserve have essentially one major monetary lever left in the toolbox, the baseline interest rate. During periods of economic malaise, the Fed turns the dial and lowers the interest rates in an attempt to boost markets by infusing them with cash from lower interest loans. When inflation creeps in, the Fed then has to turn the dial in the other direction, raising interest rates to curb rising prices. This is what they did in 1913. Don't you love it? Modern monetary theory throws out the dial and replaces it with a gigantic control panel full of levers, knobs, and switches that allow bureaucrats to manage the economy and society as they see fit. Sounds a little like something from the people who are calling for the great reset of the global economy, doesn't it? Those calling for the great reset like the idea of modern monetary theory so much, they invited the face of MMT, Stephanie Kelton, to speak on behalf of the economic theory during a November 2020 World Economic Forum virtual event promoting the great reset. Footnote 241. During her segment, Kelton told the panel they need not worry about debt and deficits, and then she explained how MMT could be used to justify massive spending programs designed to transform society. Quote, governments can establish where it is they want to go, and they can provide the kind of large-scale and patient finance that can remain in place for the duration of the time we are going to be making transformative investments in our economy moving forward, end quote. Kelton promised this to the Great Reset overlords, who I can just imagine couldn't have been happier to hear about the magic of the modern monetary theory. End of the dollar. While MMTers attempt to paint their proposed monetary system as merely a more efficient way of managing the economy, it is in reality an incredibly risky experiment. And what happens if the experiment goes awry? As I mentioned earlier, modern monetary theorists try to soothe critics' concern about hyperinflation by saying even if the government bureaucrats and policymakers don't manage things perfectly in the future, the U.S. dollar's status as the world's reserve currency would protect Americans from hyperinflation and its nightmares. Well, okay, there is no question that the dollar's world reserve currency status would help at first. But who is going to say that the dollar would remain the global reserve currency in a universe in which the United States chose to embrace modern monetary theory? As recently as July 2020, Goldman Sachs warned that the dollar is increasingly at risk of losing its world reserve status. Strategists for Goldman specifically cited the Federal Reserve's swelling balance sheet and growing debt levels as the primary reasons for their worries. 242. If the United States were to aggressively travel further down the money printing road, as Stephanie Kelton and others have suggested, it is entirely possible and probably inevitable that other economic powerhouses like China would demand that their international commerce occur using alternate currencies like the euro or the Chinese yuan. Many government institutions and government leaders in Europe and Asia have already started floating the idea of shifting the reserve currency to the International Monetary Fund's Special Drawing Rights, SDR. SDR is essentially composed of a basket of currencies and designed to act as a stable medium of exchange for international trade. Quick side note, the International Monetary Fund is one of the biggest supporters of the Great Reset. I'm sure that, however, is just a coincidence. If the government and the Federal Reserve continue to pursue an MMT system, the U.S. dollar will become increasingly vulnerable to losing its world reserve currency status. This would likely cause the same hyperinflation that Kelton and others insist would never occur under their model, because countries would have no place to spend their greenbacks except in the United States, leading to an unprecedented flood of dollars returning to U.S. shores. This would drive prices in key industries like real estate and likely to send America into an economic depression that would far exceed coronavirus lockdown levels, as hard as that is for many to imagine. This scenario would be a truly horrifying economic nightmare, the likes of which this country has never seen before. It should give pause to everyone who has embraced or even flirted seriously with MMT and its reckless principles. Oh, and things could be even worse than the situation I just described. A special drawing rights model relying on a printed currency could end up being our best case scenario. Some influential economists and world leaders associated with the World Economic Forum are trying to dethrone the dollar by replacing it with a global digital currency. Now, consider what WEF board member Mark Carney, an economist and banker with an unquestionably impressive resume. Carney previously served as the governor of the Bank of Canada, as well as the governor of the Bank of England. He spends his days convincing other elites that the U.S. dollar is too influential in global markets and should be replaced with a digital currency. In his role as the governor of the Bank of England, Carney began to lay the groundwork out to give digital currencies greater standing with the bank and throughout the world. And at the 2019 Economic Policy Symposium at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, an annual conference attended by many of the world's central bankers, Carney touted the benefits of a new digital currency replacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency. Quote, "A digital currency could dampen the domineering influence of the U.S. dollar on global trade," Carney said. "The dollar's influence on global financial conditions could similarly decline if financial architecture developed around a new digital currency and displaced the dollar's dominance in credit markets," end quote. Carney is not alone. One of the biggest advocates for expanding the power of government-controlled digital currencies is the Chinese Communist Party. China is currently in the lead when it comes to creating the first digital currency backed by a large central bank. The digital yuan would allow the Chinese Communist Party to maintain unprecedented control over its country's finances. Chinese officials have already said they plan to use the digital yuan to better manage the economy and track and eliminate, quote, illegal transactions, which in China could be something as simple as going to a website the Communist Party doesn't like. And if China is doing it, you know the rest of the world's governing elites are paying attention, especially at the World Economic Forum, where influential Chinese citizens serve as board members. And in the latest conference for the Great Reset, President Xi was the keynote speaker. Given Carney and China's connections to the World Economic Forum, it should not surprise you to hear that WEF is already preparing to give their expert opinion on how to regulate government-controlled digital currencies, which many at WEF believe to be inevitable. In January 2020, the WEF announced the creation of the very first global consortium focused on designing a framework for governance of digital currencies, end quote. Speaking at the consortium in early 2020, WEF founder and executive chairman Klaus Schwab said, "We hope that hosting this consortium will catalyze the conversations necessary to inform a robust framework of governance for global digital currency." Yeah? Oh, boy. Even the Federal Reserve in the United States is now trying to get in on the fun. On February 28, 2021, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said exploring the creation of a central bank digital currency is, quote, "a high priority project for us." 250. Referring to the possibility of a digital currency, Powell added, "This is going to be an important year. This is going to be the year in which we engage with the public pretty actively," end quote. And remember, the idea of an International Monetary Fund SDR system for the world reserve currency that I mentioned earlier in the chapter, it turns out that supporters are also considering pushing for a digital SDR currency. Back in 2019, during a Bank of England forum, Christine Lagarde, who was then the director of the IMF and is currently serving as president of the European Central Bank, discussed the idea of developing a digital version of SDR. This concept, dubbed IMF coin, could easily become the world's new reserve currency in a scenario, Lagarde said, is, quote, "not a far-fetched hypothetical," end quote. The amount of power and control over the world that would come with the full embrace of an MMT system, especially if mixed with a digital currency, is almost too much to fathom. Dare I say, it's biblical. Not only would world government and central banks be able to create as much money as they wanted to, they could, depending on how the new monetary framework operates, create and distribute cash with a push of a button, literally. Quote, "There's another round of angry riots in Paris over high energy costs. Put some of the newly minted digital cash into their digital wallets and politely tell them go home." Oh, we tried that and they aren't listening? Okay, empty their wallets then of all of their cash and see if that gets their attention. It's also worth considering how digital currencies would be used to control economic behavior. If all currency were to become digitized and physical mediums of exchange were phased out, then banks, financial institutions, governments would be able to track and control nearly every transaction in the world. Now, there is no way of knowing exactly how they might try to use this unprecedented power, but it's not hard to imagine how it could expand the authority of elites and impact regular people on a daily basis. We've all heard about local governments' attempts to tax and in some cases ban certain unhealthy foods, everything from foods containing trans fats to sugary drinks. In a world with a centralized digital currency, what's to stop the ruling class from putting a limit on the number of, Cokes you buy each week, or the number of meat burgers you eat, or the number of alcoholic beverages you consume, or cigars you smoke? What's to stop elites from preventing you from buying alcohol, cigarettes, Twinkies, the car you like? Because they're all bad for you or the collective. And what about limits on energy consumption? Perhaps you've done more than your fair share of traveling this year and deemed not important enough for a travel exemption. We can't have you polluting the planet on yet another unnecessary family vacation. I am confident the Second Amendment will survive the Great Reset, or at least on paper. It is incredibly difficult to change the Constitution, and there are too many states that would never agree to ratify an amendment that overturns the Second Amendment for gun rights to be stripped away in Congress. However, a Great Reset world that runs on a government-controlled global digital currency could make guns and ammunition sales virtually impossible. Powerful bankers and international institutions cannot make it illegal to ban guns in America, but they could stop people from buying or selling guns using their global currency, effectively killing most of the gun and ammunition industries. And if you think for a minute that Americans might be able to escape this sort of control because transactions occurring within our country might still continue to be made using U.S. dollars, remember the Federal Reserve is also strongly considering adopting its own digital currency. So whether it's the elites in Europe or China making the rules or elites at the Fed, the point is you will not be the one in control of your own economic decision making. At least that's the way things are currently shaping up. I could go on for days citing other potential problems that could arise from a centralized government-controlled digital currency, but I think you get the point. If international elites were to have authority over the world's digital currency, then they would have the power to control most of the global economic activity and, by extension, all human behavior. As the old saying goes, he who has the gold makes the rules, or more accurately, but not quite as catchy, he who has the otherwise worthless digital currency everyone is required to accept as the only valid medium of exchange makes the rules. Now, at this point, you may be wondering, if modern monetary theory is an important component to the Great Reset, why are some elites at the World Economic Forum trying to undercut the dollar's position as the world's reserve currency? Why can't the ruling class just continue relying on the dollar, perhaps a digital dollar like the one Powell has alluded to? Unfortunately, all I can do at this point is speculate, but there are plenty of good justifications that ruling class elites might have for wanting to move on from the dollar. For starters, one of the biggest impediments to the globalist agenda over the past several decades has been the unwillingness of the United States to go along with internationalism. There have been many movements throughout modern history when globalists thought they had the world right where they wanted it, but then those darn Americans in their Scooby-Doo van got in the way. They did something unexpected, like elect Donald Trump as president. There is seemingly an endless amount of material I could point to showing that global elites view America's role in the world as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, impediments to ushering in the Great Reset, like alterations to the international economy. But some of the best evidence comes by way of George Soros, one of the most influential voices in the globalist movement. Since the 1980s, Soros and his Open Society Foundations, one of the wealthiest philanthropic organizations on the planet, have spent more than $14 billion on a variety of causes in more than 100 countries. Leaked documents from Soros's Open Society Foundation show it is, quote, clearly devoted to the eradication of national sovereignty, end quote, and using a crisis to advance its political and social goals. The elimination of national sovereignty is Soros's guiding principle, one that has helped shape most of his political and philanthropic work. In an article for The Guardian by Daniel Bessner, a professor at the University of Washington and contributing editor for the popular socialist magazine Jacobin, Bessner correctly notes that in Soros's mind, quote, the two major threats to an open society are capitalistic hyper-globalization and market fundamentalism, end quote. He explains, Soros argued that the history of the post-Cold War world, as well as his personal experiences as one of international finance's most successful traders, demonstrated that unregulated global capitalism undermined open society in three distinctive ways. First, because capital could move anywhere to avoid taxation. Western nations were deprived of the finances they needed to provide citizens with public goods. Second, because international lenders were not subject to much regulation, they often engaged in unsound lending practices that threatened financial stability. Finally, because these realities increased domestic and international inequality. Soros feared they would encourage people to commit unspecified acts of desperation that could damage the global system's viability. End quote. For Soros, the only way to address these and other related perceived problems is to establish a new global system of political decision-making. Footnote 257. Wow, this really kind of sounds an awful lot like the Great Reset, doesn't it? But I'm sure it's just another coincidence. However, Soros has continuously identified one gigantic roadblock standing in the way of his dream of advancing the cause of internationalism, and that, as stated by him, is America. Bessner explains that, quote, as early as 1998, Soros acknowledged that the U.S. was the primary opponent of global institutions by this point in time. Americans had refused to join the International Court of Justice, had declined to sign the Ottawa Treaty on banning landmines, and had unilaterally imposed economic sanctions where and when they saw fit, end quote. Soros spelled this belief out clearly in his 2007 book, The Age of Fallibility, which, by the way, is agonizingly boring. Quote, the main obstacle, well, let me do it like him. The main obstacle to stable and just world order is United States. This is harsh, indeed, even for me, painful thing to say. But unfortunately, I am convinced that it is true. United States continues to set agenda for world in spite of its loss of influence since 9/11 and Bush administration setting up wrong agenda. Bush agenda nationalistic. It emphasizes use of force, ignores global problems whose solution requires international cooperation. I know he's not really Russian, but he kind of sounds better as a Russian, doesn't he? Soros's views are pervasive in international circles of influence. So is it really surprising that many globalists are keen on pushing the dollar out of its position of prominence? Would they really want to trust control of the lifeblood of their Great Reset system to a currency operating under MMT principles? To a country with strong independent streak like the United States? No, I highly doubt it. From their perspective, it would be much better if the international ruling class had its own currency, preferably one that was easy for elites to manage and one where a guy like Donald Trump isn't certainly suddenly in control. What could possibly be easier than to control a digital currency? MMT success stories. Modern monetary theorists are often confronted by skeptics concerned about the elites gambling with America's future on a largely unproven economic theory. When that happens, Kelton and other supporters of MMT usually respond by arguing that many of their ideas have actually been tried before and with great success in the mysterious ancient land of Japan. The following argument by Kelton is just one example out of many showing how modern monetary theorists usually present this important claim. Quote, "So it's impossible, really, to put a number. I mean, no one can. How much debt is too much debt? Well, if you look at Japan today, you'll see a country where the debt-to-GDP ratio is something like 240%, well above, orders of magnitude above, where the U.S. is today, or even where the U.S. is forecast to be in the future. And so the question is, how is Japan able to sustain a debt of that size? Wouldn't it have an inflation problem? Wouldn't it lead to rising interest rates? Wouldn't this be destructive in some way?" And the answer to all of those questions, as Japan has demonstrated now for years, is simply no. Japan's debt is close to 240% of GDP, almost a quadrillion. That's a big number in yen. Long-term interest rates are very close to zero. There's no inflation. And so despite the size of the debt, there are no negative consequences as a result. And I think Japan teaches us a really important lesson, end quote. All right, before I address Kelton's argument here, take a minute to marvel at her assertion. A 240% debt to GDP ratio is completely acceptable. If translated to America, that amount would be a national debt of more than $51 trillion. Okay, that is more money than all of the money on Earth currently in circulation, paper and digital, all of the money from around the world combined. You know what that means? Ponies for everybody. Uncle Sam is picking up the tab. Now, I admit that Kelton is correct in asserting that Japan has yet to suffer through high levels of inflation, even though it has amassed a staggering level of debt. However, as with everything else in life, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Japan is far from the MMT utopia that Kelton would have you believe. Although Japan's government has spent trillions on construction-related public investment over the past three decades, precisely the type of spending that MMTers propose, economic growth has almost totally stagnated. Japan's problems began long before the coronavirus pandemic hit. From 1995 to 2018, Japan's GDP decreased by more than 8%. Over the same time period, the United States has experienced 168% growth in GDP. Further, in Japan, the percentage of the GDP composed of government spending has also steadily increased over the last two decades, showing that substantially more economic power has to be vested in the hands of the Japanese government over that period. So now with this in mind, should Americans really consider Japan an MMT success story? It is an anemic economy, massive amounts of debt, and increased size of government, something most Americans pine for? I am no mind reader, but I hope to say that it is still safe to bet that when faced with these facts, most people in the United States would want nothing to do with modern monetary theory. MMT in America. When I first heard about the concept of modern monetary theory, I probably, like you, thought it was nothing more than yet another delusional fantasy concocted by ivory tower elites that had as much of a chance to become a reality as I have of winning a gold medal for figure skating at the next Olympics. Which, just to be clear, I'm not an exactly graceful ice skater, but I can kneecap people. If 2020 taught us anything, it is that the groundwork for a large-scale shift to modern monetary theory has already been laid, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic. The United States appears to be on the MMT train at this very moment, even though most Americans still haven't even heard of the concept. In the aftermath of the Great Recession of 2008, politicians began constructing a plan to stimulate the economy. Competing plans outlined ways to get people back to work and stabilize markets. After much negotiating between reckless politicians in the Republican and Democratic parties, President Obama signed into law the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, a price that at the time we all thought was crazy, $830 billion. At that time, we chastised Obama for being fiscally reckless, while liberals celebrated Obama for taking bold action to save the economy. However, in 2019 and 2020, MMTers like Kelton called Obama basically a conservative when it came to fiscal policy. And congressional Republicans and their Republican president passed legislation in a single year that added more money to the national debt than nearly every other president in history did during their full terms in office. This proves that modern monetary theory has already moved from being a fringe concept supported by a small band of mostly unknown academics to a mainstream practice embraced by politicians, both in the GOP and the Democratic Party. Additionally, some of MMT's biggest names have risen to the highest rungs of power in America. As I mentioned earlier in the chapter, Kelton served as the chief economist for the Democratic Party staff on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee and as a key economic advisor to Bernie Sanders during his 2016-2020 presidential election. And Kelton also served on Joe Biden's 2020 Unity Task Force, where she heavily influenced Biden's platform and first-year policies. Just a decade ago, MMT academics like Kelton were being laughed out of the room. Today, they are advising presidents and congressional budget committees, and the popularity of modern monetary theory is likely to grow within the academic community in the years to come, especially in the wake of George Soros's sudden and strange infatuation with small liberal arts colleges in upstate New York. At a January 2020 speech before the, you guessed it, World Economic Forum, Soros announced that he was launching a new kind of global educational network to, quote, advance the values of an open society, including Soros's commitment to internationalism, footnote 266. Soros pledged $1 billion to the new association, which he named the Open Society University Network. Increasingly, the two colleges leading the network are Central European University, a graduate college in Vienna founded by Soros, and Bard College, a small liberal arts school in the United States that enrolls around 2,200 undergraduate students. Soros also named in 2020 the president of Bard College, Leon Botstein, as the Open Society University Network's first chancellor. This is a position Botstein had filled while continuing to serve as Bard's president. Even more remarkably, less than 7 months after Soros announced the creation of the Open Society University Network, his Open Society Foundations agreed to give Bard $100 million. Wow, he sure loves the Bard College. If Bard sounds familiar to you, it's because of earlier in the chapter, I mentioned it when discussing L. Randall Ray and Pavlina Cherneva, two of the world's leading modern monetary theory economists, both of whom work as influential professors at the Bard College. Bard is also the home to the Levy Economic Institute, the epicenter of modern monetary theory scholarship. So not only does the Levy Economic Institute feature the work of Ray, Cherneva, and other MMT academics and organize the international conferences on modern monetary theory, but it also counts as one of its researchers, the queen of modern monetary theory, Stephanie Kelton. Now, I suppose it's all just a coincidence that George Soros chose to make Bard College the mecca of modern monetary theory movement, the leading institution in Soros's new $1 billion global education network. I suppose it is also possible that there is some special reason not related to MMT that Soros has decided to give the college $100 million to name as its president the chancellor of his new international network. But in my experience, when it comes to Mr. Soros, there is no such thing as coincidence. I cannot prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, of course, but I am willing to bet that the reason Soros is building his new educational network around Bard College is because of the small school's devotion to to modern monetary theory. And because Soros knows that if modern monetary theory were to be fully embraced by leading U.S. institutions, it would inevitably push the entire world towards a more centralized governing structure, one that would give powerful elites control over nearly every economic decision, either directly or indirectly. And that is the goal that Soros has been working towards for decades. And with modern monetary theory systems fully in place, he, as well as supporters of the Great Reset, know it could finally become a reality. Fueling the machine. Like the elite's plan to create the Federal Reserve System more than 100 years ago, embracing MMT will probably start with a meeting of the country's most powerful government officials, bankers, and business people who will travel from every corner of the globe to devise a plan to reset the world economic system. And when they do, I am sure they will erroneously assure the American people that creating trillions of dollars out of thin air and disregarding the national debt would open the door to a new era of economic growth. Thanks to this book, you will know why you should not trust them. And thanks to this book, if you see Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, or Stephanie Kelton dressed as duck hunters boarding a train in the middle of the night, you'll know what's going on. The Great Reset is a machine manufactured to usher in a new, highly sophisticated, technologically advanced, 21st century brand of international fascism, one with a corporatist twist. But powerful machines like the Great Reset cannot operate without fuel. That is what modern monetary theory provides. By offering seemingly endless amounts of money that can be used as fuel to pay for just about anything the government, corporations, or financial institutions can dream up, it continues to chug on. COVID-19 created the conditions for the machine's existence. Without an urgent global crisis that could normalize modern monetary theory and burn down well-established economic and societal norms, the world would never have allowed the Great Reset to emerge as a viable option. People like Greta Thunberg would have screamed and shouted and shamed all day long, but it never would have resulted in the progress she wanted because everyone else in society had way too much to lose. But as important as COVID-19 has been for the Great Reset, it is climate change that provides the key, the long-term justification for far-reaching, sustained transformation of society. Without a decades-long existential crisis for governments and business leaders to rally around, the coronavirus pandemic would be nothing more than a fleeting public policy challenge. A larger one, no doubt, but temporary, and thus not useful for the sort of grand structural changes dreamt up by the Great Reset's leaders. It is climate change policies, fueled by modern monetary theory, that ultimately provide the foundation upon which everything can be built for the New World Order, that Greenpeace's Jennifer Morgan alluded to in her Great Reset presentation before the World Economic Forum in mid-2020. But what exactly does that new world look like? That is the topic of the next chapter, The Great Reset, Building a 21st Century Fascism Machine. Chapter 5, The Great Reset, Building a 21st Century Fascism Machine. First of all, we have to have the definition of reset correctly. Reset. We can't think of it in terms of a sort of pushing of a button and going back to the way things were. The normal was a crisis. The normal itself was not working. John Kerry, speaking at a World Economic Forum event titled Redesigning Social Contracts in Crisis, June 24th, 2020. An international conspiracy between powerful bankers, business leaders, and government officials, secret meetings in the Swiss Alps, and calls for a new world order. The Great Reset is one henchman with an eye patch away from being a great plot for the next James Bond movie, which, By the way, it means that when Hollywood inevitably makes a blockbuster Great Reset film, the role of Glenn Beck will be played by Daniel Craig, which makes perfect sense to me, but not so much to my wife. In previous chapters, I have shown how the Great Reset will be fueled, modern monetary theory, how the conditions have come about that make it possible, the coronavirus pandemic, and what the justification is for the destruction of the current world economic system, claims of an existential climate change crisis. But to this point, I have deliberately avoided explaining the specific policy changes that the Great Reset supporters have in mind when they talk about their plans for the future. And there is a very good reason for that. Parts of the Great Reset are very, very complicated. Unlike conservative political figures like Ted Cruz or Rand Paul, or left-leaning politicians like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who typically have no problem telling the American people exactly where they stand on issues, those who favor the Great Reset often shroud their plans using coded language, largely unknown economic theories, and incredibly complex charts and diagrams that make whatever the heck that guy in A Beautiful Mind was sketching look like a children's maze on the back of a Denny's kids menu. Making matters worse, the Great Reset's biggest backers have deliberately chosen to use terminology that sounds appealing to many supporters of free markets like capitalism, investments, and stakeholders, while meaning something very different from what many of us think of when we hear these ideas discussed in the United States. Of course, at times, the Great Reset movement could not be clearer. When advocates of the reset say, to achieve a better outcome, the world must act jointly and swiftly to revamp all aspects of our societies and economies, from education to social contracts and working conditions, end quote, they mean it, 273. Likewise, when they say, we need a great reset of capitalism, they mean that too, 274. And when they say, we are completely rethinking the tools of economic policy, they are not lying, 275. But as shocking as those and many other Great Reset-related statements are, they do not come even remotely close to painting the truly horrifying transformation of the world that the Great Reset movement has in mind when it talks about building its new global society. And although you will not hear Great Resetters openly calling for authoritarianism, the Great Reset is clearly a new kind of soft authoritarianism that is not too far off from the merging of markets, corporatism, authoritarianism, collectivism, and modern technology that has been embraced by the Communist Party of China in recent decades. Its confusing terminology and vague language are what make the Great Reset so dangerous and, frankly, brilliant. Openly calling for a takeover of the global economy by the ruling class would immediately alienate 90% of the general population. But by tying in the Green New Deal, a government jobs guarantee, and a host of large social welfare programs, they have managed to win over some progressives and socialists who care deeply about those issues. And by painting the movement as pro-business, pro-capitalism, a plan to improve the economy, they have managed to win over some establishment political figures on the right. But at its core, the Great Reset is not truly pro-socialism, and it is not pro-capitalism either. It is just a rebranding of the same old tired ideas that elites have pushed a million times before. Give us more power, and we promise we'll take care of you and fix the world's ills. Let us manage more of the economy, and we promise you you'll all be wealthier for it. Give us the authority to punish the bad guys in society, and we'll save the planet from annihilation. I admit that the Great Reset is a little cleverer, is that even a word, than some of the schemes that the ruling class have trotted out before. But in the end, no matter what label the elitist snake oil salesman slaps on the front of the bottle, it is still poison that he is trying to sell you. Or as former Texas Governor Ann Richards once said, you can put lipstick on a hog and call it Monique, but it's still a pig. And make no mistake about it, the Great Reset is a pig, a big, fat, trough-licking pig. The trick to stopping the Great Reset, then, is first knowing how to recognize the poison, and then how to keep our friends, family, and neighbors from guzzling it down. So let's start with understanding. What exactly is the Great Reset? How do the global elites plan to impose it on the entire world? The road to serfdom. The first thing you need to know about the Great Reset is that, at least at the time of this writing, there is no official Great Reset manual, framework, or agreement that all Great Reset advocates have signed up for. It is possible such a platform will be released when the World Economic Forum holds its annual meeting, but currently you cannot go to one single place and see everything that the Great Reset entails. The Great Reset has often been presented one component at a time, as though you're given a puzzle with all of the pieces and the theme, but without a picture of what it would look like when completed. The obscurity of the final picture is, I believe, deliberate. It is much harder for people who would otherwise be deeply concerned about the Great Reset to spend too much time worrying about it because, honestly, it takes a lot of effort just to figure out what the reset really is. Luckily for you, I'm a puzzle guy. My research team and I have spent months putting all of the Great Reset pieces together so you don't have to. The best place to find information about the Great Reset is on the website of the World Economic Forum. As I have said all the way through this and pointed out certain important footnotes, go to the original source. Don't take my word for it, and certainly don't go to conspiracy websites. It's important we all are anchored in the facts. The World Economic Forum, the leaders of the Great Reset movement, host a large archive of articles, interviews, podcasts, and videos about the reset, much of which features academics, business, and government leaders and activists from around the world, including America. There's one article published on June 3rd, 2020 on WEF's website. World Economic Forum founder and executive chairman Klaus Schwab discusses in broad but relatively clear terms some of the main goals of the Great Reset. There are so many reasons to pursue a Great Reset, Schwab wrote, but the most urgent is COVID-19. Having already led to hundreds of thousands of deaths, the pandemic represents one of the worst public health crises in recent history. And with casualties still mounting in many parts of the world, it is far from over, end quote. He then cites climate change, income inequality, and other crises as key justifications for a great reset of capitalism. And then he explains, quote, left unaddressed, these crises will deepen and leave the world even less sustainable, less equal, and more fragile. Incremental measures and ad hoc fixes will not suffice to prevent this scenario. We must build entirely new foundations for our economic and social systems, end quote, 278. Schwab says there are three main components to the Great Reset agenda. One is mostly uncontroversial, quote, to harness the innovations of the fourth industrial revolution to support the public good, especially by addressing health and social challenges. During the COVID-19 crisis, companies, universities, and others have joined forces to develop diagnostics, therapeutics, and possible vaccines, establish testing centers, create mechanisms for tracking infections, and deliver telemedicine. Imagine what could be solved if similar concerted efforts were made in every sector. That's a direct quote from Klaus Schwab. There are few people in the Western world who believe that technological advancements won't play a key role in future economic development. And some of the innovations Schwab cites, such as telemedicine, are something I've been talking about for a couple of decades. Unfortunately, here in America, it took a pandemic to convince many in government to loosen regulations and make key reforms so that telemedicine and similar services made possible by recent technological achievements are available to everyone. I guess talking to your doctor through applications like Skype was just too much innovation for bureaucrats to handle. Don't you just love the government? Two other components Schwab outlines is where the real fun begins. According to Schwab, quote, the first component of the Great Reset would steer the market toward fairer outcomes. To this end, governments should improve coordination, for example, in tax, regulatory, and fiscal policy, upgrade trade arrangements, and create the conditions for a stakeholder economy. At a time of diminishing tax bases and soaring public debt, governments have a powerful incentive to pursue such action. Still quoting, moreover, governments should implement long overdue reforms that promote more equitable outcomes. Depending on the country, these may include changes to wealth taxes, to the withdrawal of fossil fuel subsidies, and new rules governing intellectual property, trade, and competition. 280. Okay, now you might be thinking, Glenn, this sounds like your standard progressive tax and spend platform, but you promised so much more. Where's the big reset of society you've been talking so much about? Hang with me, because you're going to get there very soon. For now, I just want you to remember that Schwab has said that the Great Reset would steer the market toward fairer outcomes, create the conditions for a stakeholder economy, and implement long overdue reforms that promote more equitable outcomes. All of these ideas are going to get fleshed out a lot more in detail later in this chapter, but you can already see that Schwab's ideas require dramatically altering the global economy and empowering someone, we'll find out who that someone is soon, with all the authority to redistribute the wealth and power. It is also important to remember that Schwab, who is really just one of the many important Great Reset advocates, is especially interested in something called the stakeholder economy. It's a concept that is vital to understand if you're going to grab the full weight of the Great Reset. Later in the same article, Schwab explains that another major component of the Great Reset agenda is to ensure that investments advance shared goals. Ensure that investments advance shared goals, such as equality and sustainability. He continues, quote, here the large-scale spending programs that many governments are implementing represent a major opportunity for progress. The European Commission, for one, has unveiled plans for a 750 billion euro, which is about $826 billion, recovery fund. The U.S., China, and Japan have also had ambitious economic stimulus plans. Rather than using these funds, as well as investments from private entities and pension funds, to fill the cracks in the old system, we should use them to create a new one that is more resilient, equitable, sustainable in the long run. This means, for example, building green urban infrastructure and creating incentives for industries to improve their track record on environmental, social, and governance, ESG, metrics, end quote, 281. The new system Schwab is referring to is a total reworking of the way people think about business and how to evaluate them. That's why the mom-and-pop business didn't get the bailout and the money, because you were just filling in the cracks of the old system. Rather than focus on profits, private property rights, supply and demand from consumers, the cornerstones of free market economies, Schwab wants to develop a system based largely on environmental, social justice, and governance metrics, which, as we will explore in just a minute or two, another more complex way of suggesting that companies should be rewarded for working toward achieving social justice goals, like fighting climate change, racial inequality, and removing Aunt Jemima from syrup bottles. What it does not mean, however, is that the Great Reset is a socialist system. It is easy to fall into this trap. I did it many times in the year leading up to this book's release. The Great Reset is fundamentally about shifting wealth and power into the hands of elites, as you will see later in this chapter. Socialists and Marxists are going to be very upset when they figure out they've been used. All of this social justice stuff that Schwab and other resetters like to talk about is smoke and mirror shows. In the end, the Great Reset machine could be used to pursue any goals the ruling class deemed important. As I warned you about earlier, in Schwab's article, he is deliberately being very vague. But there are already several reasons to be alarmed. First, Schwab wants to reset capitalism and create a new system. Second, that new system would be focused on equality or equity of all outcomes. Not equality under the law. That's a goal rejected by market-based economies. And although Schwab does not say it in the passage quoted here, we will discover elsewhere that the equality Schwab wants isn't just among people within a nation, but between nations as well. The Great Reset, without a doubt, is an international movement, and we are the richest kid on the block that needs to be taken down a peg or two. Third, Schwab wants national governments and central banks to spend